On world religions, the major single point that I would like to make, and I think you'll see it by the time we're finished, that you can take every religion of the world and put it over here, and put Christianity over here, and it is totally, totally, totally different. Because all the religions are man reaching up for God, and Christianity is God reaching down in sovereign grace to save man. And I hope that will come across very strongly as we go through these various religions. Tonight, we're going to look at Hinduism from four standpoints. Its country, you cannot consider it apart from India. Two, its complexity. Three, its writings. And four, its vocabulary. So we begin tonight. Hinduism. Its country. You can safely simply say that Hinduism is the religion of India. Not only is it the religion of India, it's the politics of India, it's everything in India, as I hope we can show. So that, first of all, something about the country of India itself. In the first place, we're looking at a population over 866 million. Enormous country, 866 million plus. The entire nation of India is 1.2 million square miles. India has at least 10 cities that are 1 million plus in population. And fourth, the first time in the history of the world, India was united in our generation, not by a statesman, but by a saint. Saint from their perspective, by a saint, we can put it in quotes, not a statesman. And those four things are important about that country. Its size is enormous. Its land territory is enormous. Its over a million city population is enormous. And its chief figure was a saint, not a statesman. The country was united by, and I don't say this in a derogatory way, but if you've seen pictures, you will agree with me, I'm sure, that India was united by the ugliest, slightest, weakest man in Asia, who had a toothless mouth, big ears, and big nose. And you know him. He slept on a bare floor. He lived on nothing but nuts and fruits and goat's milk. He fasted repeatedly. And he made the following statement: I can as well do without my eyes as without fasts. What the eyes are for the outer world, fasts are for the inner. And as you know, we're talking about Mahatma Gandhi, who was a complete ascetic, and for the first time in Indian history, united the nations. When you look at India, politics, from their viewpoint, are not important at all. In India, the important thing is religion. If you look at their history, you can see that India has been ruled by tyrants, by tolerant people, by good people, and frankly, the Indians do not care. The reason they do not care who rules them or exploits them is because the important matter is religion, not politics. And therefore, you have two very fundamental things in the thinking of the citizens of India. Two fundamentals, and they are: number one, it is the soul, not the body, that is important. It is the soul, not the body, is important. And this is hard to identify with, because as far as we're concerned in America, it's the reverse. Our physical pleasures, our physical happiness, our emotional happiness is more important than relationship in terms of the soul. Number two, it's endless lives, not this life, that is important. And those two very fundamental things are part and parcel of the religion of India. Religion is more important than politics. Who rules, who reigns, who exploits is not the issue. At least it's not the primary issue. The primary issue is not food for my body. The primary issue is my soul. I guess we could put it this way. You couldn't sell the finest health care reform in the whole world to India. India doesn't care about the body. India cares, by and large, and it's not the soul in the proper sense, but from the religious standpoint, they do not care about the body primarily. That's a secondary thing. It is the soul that is of great importance. And it is not this life on which we focus, it's this life and the next life and the next life and the next life and the next life that is important as far as Hindu religion is concerned. That's basically its relationship to its country. Politics is not important, religion is important. Second, Hinduism, its complexity. Hinduism is probably the most complex religion in the world, both now and historically, extremely complex. And the reason for that is the fact that it has spawned hundreds of sects. Hinduism has spawned many, many sects. If you read about the history of Hinduism, you're immediately struck with the fact that almost all books will deal with early Hinduism and later Hinduism. And you want to ask, why don't you just handle Hinduism as a whole? Why early and why later? And there's an answer for that. The early Hinduism spawned a sect that became very big. And it sort of, quote, unquote, interrupted the history of Hinduism. And what was that sect? Buddhism. And therefore, the history books inevitably are early Hinduism, Buddhism, later Hinduism. And the reason for the break is Buddhism was a reactionary religion that said, I do not like some of the things. It was a consensus with the people. We do not like what is being taught in Hinduism. We do not like its practices. And they broke on the basis of three sects, basic doctrines that we'll talk about tonight. But it spawned many sects. Among them, again, was Buddhism. And while it is true that Buddhism is really the religion of China, early Buddhism wasn't. It was a religion of India. Gautama was an Indian, not Chinese. But it grew greatly in China, so that we are going to be able to say Hinduism, the religion of India, and we're going to be able to say Buddhism, the religion of China. But nonetheless, this is where it started. So here are some of the remarks that are made about the religion. Hinduism is not a religion. It is a family of religions. It is not a religion, but a family of religions. It encompasses really every kind of religious experience you can imagine. For example, I'll just put down the word broad. It's very broad. And let me give you some examples. There are honorable Hindus who are pantheists. There are others who are polytheists. There are others who are monotheists. There are others that are agnostic. And it is even possible, and there are some that practice Hinduism, who are atheists. So what do you want to believe in? Many gods? One god? Nature is a god? Or no god at all? Or we just don't know? And all that falls within the umbrella of that. And therefore, since it's so broad, we can add another word. It is also very tolerant. It's a broad religion. It's a very tolerant religion. In Hinduism, there is basically one rule. And that rule is this. If you abide by the rules of your caste, if you abide by the rules of your caste, and we'll talk about the caste system, C-A-S-T-E. If you abide by the rules of your caste, by so doing, you will have in your next birth a happier life. Abide by the rules of your caste, and by so doing, your next life will be happier. you will come back a happier person. Again, shot through all these religions is what? Salvation by works. Every last one of them is salvation by works. And this is basically, if you're going to be a practicing Hindu, that's what you must remember. Whatever the rules of your caste, and we'll mention the four class and the thousands of subcastes that come along, and then those that are in no caste, which are called what? Outcasts. Did you know the word outcast was originally spelled with an E? We mean outcast, someone thrown out. Outcast, by its origin, was C-A-S-T-E. It means you don't fit in any caste. And consequently, you're in big trouble. But nonetheless, this is the basic rule. You got to keep the rules of your caste. And in doing that, your next life is going to be happier. Hinduism sees in all religion sameness. And as a Christian, I have to agree with that. There is a sameness in all religions. And that sameness is, we weren't going over the word religion, did we not? R-E-L-I-G-A-R-E, Latin religare, which means to bind together. And therefore, all religion has a common point. And that common point is it's man's attempt to bring himself into harmony with the powers to be. And I'll put power or powers either way. And that power can be a person, like a personal god. It can be many gods. It could be no gods at all, just forces, fire, water, things of that sort. But that's basically what man does in religion. And the point I want to establish is that you can break religion, frankly, into two categories. One is Christianity and the other is world religion. And let me give some of the contrast. Christianity is man's move to save man on the basis of grace. Religion is man's move to come into harmony with God. Man's religion, a religion is man's reach upward for God. Christianity is God's reach downward for man. Religion is human good. Christianity is divine grace. Religion focuses on thousands of humans' rites and rituals. Christianity focuses on the single work of one man, the cross of Christ. And a major point I like to make in these studies, and I don't think I'll have to make the point because I think you're going to see it, is notice the contrast in those things. Now, a little bit about what do we mean about religion, and this is really not a break, but it's something I want to give. When we talk about religion or binding together, let me state probably, I think, the best way it's ever been put, and that's by St. Augustine. He has two questions, and it's sort of addressing and talking to God in these questions. Augustine said, what place is there in me into which God can come? Even he who made heaven and earth. Is there anything in me, O Lord, my God, that can contain you? Or should I not rather say that I could not exist unless I were in thee, from whom are all things, by whom are all things, in whom are all things? And then he said, to put it very briefly, the most important question I could ever ask. Must I reach upward to find God, or must God in infinite grace find me? And that is eloquently put between the two that are similar. So, and I think you can see when you think of religion, whether it's formal or whether it's people just think, isn't religion basically man knowing that I really can't stand alone? I've got to have at least cooperation from outside of me. I'm not dependent. I've got to have help. I've got to have protection. I've got to have a sense of dependence. Now, the thought of religion stands in contrast to the thought of Scripture. Let me show you why. Religious thought is not biblical thought. Religious thought is not biblical thought. As a matter of fact, they are quite opposite. Religious thought is not biblical thought. And here is why. Religious thought, I'll just put RT, religious thought is man rising from low to high. Biblical thought is man starting high and falling low. Now let me illustrate that as we have done previously. Biblical thought is man started way up here with knowing God, and he stair step down. Religious thought is man is climbing a ladder, and he's discovering and finding and fathoming God all the way up his climb. Religion is man's climb for the top. Christianity is man's fall from the top and God's rescue and grace. And that's, again, a strong contrast to the two. Let's go back to our illustration. You've got an aircraft in the air, and you've got one crashed on the side of the mountain. Question, which was the original aircraft? The one on the mountainside or the one in the air? Is the wreckage on the mountainside the remains of something once great? Or is the aircraft flying above the end of something once wrecked? You see how your thought can go? I realize that for us it's so obvious the one crashed on the mountain is not going to rise into the one above. But can you see the logic of how you could think? There's one up here, there's one down here. You've never seen one before. I wonder if the one up there came from this one down here that's rubbish on the mountainside. Or I wonder if the one that's on the mountainside came from up there. Which way did it go? And that basically is your difference between the two. And let's look at primitive religion then from the standpoint of Romans 1. And we only need to read the verses. And you'll see that the one on the mountainside is the wreckage of something once great. And notice how we start high and go low. We start with the knowledge of God and deteriorate to the forms of religion. Verse 21, for even though they knew God, now we start down. They did not honor him as God or give thanks, became futile in their speculations, foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for the image in the form of corruptible man, birds, four-footed animals, and crawling creatures. Now, which way are we going? Are we going up to down or down up? Well, the scripture here is going to teach that it is that man is the wreckage of something much, much greater. And that leads us then to this last verse, which describes what we might call primitive religion. Now, in stating some of these principles, these are pretty much consensus among students or scholars of religion, that basically primitive religion has the following elements, and we want to go right back down to the basic roots. Primitive religion always starts, and what I'm talking about, you walk into a jungle and you see, what are these people doing? What aspects of their life is religious? What is part of primitive religion? What's it like? Number one, recognition of something as sacred. That's where it starts. Recognition that something is sacred. And that something could be a person. It could be a place. It could be a thing. And therefore, that person, place, or thing is treated with special awe. And if you simply study the history of man and the history of civilizations, you inevitably will have this in some form. That somehow inculcated in every man, is there something out there that's sacred? It may be a person that's sacred, a chief of a tribe. It may be a place, this holy mountain, this holy stone. Stones have always been favorites of religion. A stone, a rock, a place, a river. a valley, a tree, something out there is sacred, and that's one of the marks of primitive religion. There is an idea of there is something sacred. And I personally believe, from the biblical standpoint, God has stamped that there. God has made man to worship himself. And if he does not worship himself, he does not lose his sense that something's holy. Something is sacred out there. Now, the second thing that inevitably comes along is when there's something sacred, we tend to look at it as having power. And therefore, anxiety rises. It's part of primitive religion. Anxiety over that object, person, place, or thing. Anxiety over that sacred object. And what that is this. If something bad happens, what we hold sacred must be pleased with us. If something good, displeased with, what I say, bad or good. If something good happens, whatever that sacred object is, must be pleased. And if something bad happens, that object recognized as sacred must be angry with us. Now, what would that, how would you say typically the anxiety is relieved? Some kind of ritual. So, anxiety is relieved by ritual of some kind. The rituals of religion, you could never count them. It's a ritual of self-torture. You cut yourself because that will certainly show my sincerity and my devotion to what I hold to be sacred. You will drink something. You will dip yourself in something. You will go a certain place. But it's all a ritual of some type. And there again, when we come to our last religion, we're talking about Christianity. We're going to talk about Christianity without ritual. Because we don't have to be dipped, painted. We don't have to put anything in our noses, anything in our ears. We don't have to shave anything. We do not have to torture ourselves. We do not have to genuflect. We do not have to go to a certain city in the world. It's all on a spiritual level. And there is the ritual is simply not there in terms of what man performs. Now, when you do the ritual, something else comes about. And it revolves about two questions. If I've offended, I do this ritual, okay? Problem. Number one, was it performed properly? And two, did I do it in time? And this is the anxiety and the tension of primitive religion. We offended the God. We went through the ritual. But he was mad 16 hours ago. So it's too late. We didn't do it promptly enough. Or maybe in going through the ritual, we had to pour blood from this cup to this cup, and we spilled a drop. And tension rises again because it was not done promptly. Now, often, and what does that do? That usually gives rise to more of it. Also involved in all primitive religion is animism. Animism simply means that, in simple terms, everything has a soul. Very similar to pantheism. Everything has a soul. And usually the belief that comes out of that, strangely enough, and I've never really been able to see the connection, but most animists believe when you dream, your soul leaves your body for a little bit. And one day, you close your eyes, and you're dead, and your soul leaves your body permanently. And that's basically an animistic type thing. So that everything has a soul, and in primitive religion, from that comes out veneration for these spirits. The spirit of the frog, the spirit of the crocodile. We read last Sunday a letter, remember, from, was it Kenya or Ghana? Nigeria, okay. From Nigeria. And the man talked about how to get to certain places they had to cross rivers. And therefore, they had developed in their culture the spirit of the crocodile as a god. It's animism. That the crocodile would have this, and therefore they pray to him. And this is part of that type of pagan religion. This man was formerly his book called "The Origin and Evolution of Religion" by E.W. Hopkins. It's put out by the Yale University Press, and he puts it so well. He is not a believer, but he is a religious historian, and he says this: man has worshipped everything he could think of beneath earth, everything between earth and heaven, and everything in the heavens above. And he was asked, what is your summary of human religion? And this was his summary. Let me read it again. How do you put all religion together? This way. Man has worshipped everything he could think of beneath the earth, everything between earth and heaven, and everything in the heavens above. And that veneration, of course, includes stones, plants, trees, animals, elements like fire and water. They're all the common elements of primitive religion. But there's one other thing that comes into here. Inevitably, in primitive religion, there's the big guy. So there's always a high god, almost always. A high god exists. And why does this come about? Someone comes along and says, we do this ritual. Where did that ritual come from? Or, we worship these spirits, and we venerate the spirit of the crocodile. Who made the spirit of the crocodile? Or, our God, as is often the case, is Father. Who was the first Father? And from that, inevitably, is developed a chief God or a high God. And then always connected, almost always connected with primitive religion, are taboos. And what that means, usually the chief of the tribe is taboo. And that means if you touch his garments, he is so filled with the spirit that if you touch his garments, you are going to be, you're forbidden to do so. And I know this man from Yale said, I can list many, many recorded instances of a person dying of fright when they heard they had unwittingly eaten the remains of a chief's meal. And these are all elements that are mixed in with religion. You know, as I go through this, people want to say that we as Christians are irrational, unintelligent, and crazy for crying out loud. What is the history of religion? Almost the history of insanity with the things that man has done. Okay, now, back to Hinduism, its writings. The writings of the Hindu are called the Veda, V-E-D-A, of which there are four. By the way, we'll talk on Wednesday night about Buddhism. The Buddhist scriptures are better than 10 times thicker than the Bible. 10 times. You take 10 Bibles, stack them up, and you've got some of the writings of Buddhism. But we'll get that next time. It's called the Veda. First of all, there's the Rig Veda, R-I-G-V-E-D-A. And that basically is stanzas of praise, or, as is included in all of the Vedas, mantras, M-A-N-T-R-A-S, mantras. And if you don't think these religions have affected us, I will promise you, you could find a schoolroom somewhere in the metropolitan Kansas City area that will begin with a mantra. Just guarantee it. This is part of this type of religion. There are over 1,000 hymns in this book, and they're addressed to deity. Let's see if I can give some examples. Oh, this has a lot about Indra, which was their chief god. And it talks about Indra and says, in his command are horses, cattle, villages, chariots. He begot the sun and dawn. He is the leader of the waters. He, O men, is Indra. And that's from the Veda. The other Vedas, the Yajur, the Sama, and the Athara Veda. And I thought I'd read you. The Athara Veda is the part of the Veda that gets into the treatment of the body by means of incantations. And Dan, you need to take notes on this because you may want to use some of these things. They developed a litany for treatment of the body, and of course, I guess where we join hands with them is there's always been a search for, is there anything that can cure baldness? Can you do anything to grow hair? And I take this from the Atharva Veda, and some of the things that you do, and who can come along and cure your baldness. Now, you may want to take these. And since these ancient religions are loaded with wisdom, and Christianity is foolishness, see if you can get some wisdom tonight. Here are three possible chants that will help you grow hair. First of all, you gather a sacred root. And that sacred root is to prevent baldness. So here's what you would do. You might say this chant. Strengthen the old hair, beget the new. That which has come forth, render more luxurious. Now, at the same time, you're anointing your head with this herb. The last few years, we've had kind of a thing in America about concoctions and herbs and what have you. And I've always wanted to say to some people that recommend something that will make me healthier, have you been getting your devotions from the Veda? At any rate. Second, here's another possibility. As a goddess upon the goddess earth thou wast born, O plant. Speaking of this thing. We dig thee up, O Natatni, that thou mayest strengthen the growth of our hair. Are you... Well, that was the third one, wasn't it? Is that the third one? Oh, here's one. That hair of mine which does drop off, and that which is broken, root and all, upon it I do sprinkle the all-healing herb. Now, I sprinkle. There were instructions with that found in the Veda. And the ancient instructions say that this patient must have his head anointed with this black concoction. It must be applied by a medicine man dressed in black who has eaten black food for the rising before the rising of the black crows in the morning. And that's part of man's... this is objective. I can hand you the Veda if the Veda turns you on, and you can read of this particular type thing. But that is part of what is found in its writings. We should add, by the way, that probably the most sacred and read book among the Hindus is the, it's spelled B-H, and it's pronounced Bhagavata. Bhagavata. Gita, G-I-T-A. It came in the 2nd century A.D., and it's the most sacred book of the Hindus, and is read more than any other book in the world by the Hindus. Now, Hinduism, its vocabulary. And I want to give you some of the vocabulary of Hinduism. And I think you can pretty much put it together if you'll learn three terms. The first is samsara. S-A-M-S-A-R-A. Samsara. Sometimes samsara is called the wheel of life. Samsara refers to the wheel of life. And it means that your life is birth and rebirth. And then birth and rebirth, and it's a wheel. This is essential to Hindu theology. It's based on the belief that the soul of man is eternal. And therefore, that eternal soul, how do you handle death? Well, you handle death by not wiping out the soul, but where does the soul go? It goes to another body. And so, this soul passes with each rebirth from one body to another. It's eternal. It passes from one body to another. Birth and rebirth. Hindu belief, spelled S-A-M-S-A-R. Samsara. Now, for the Hindu, there is one aim in life that overrules all others. So the aim of life is to escape samsara, to escape the cycle. And that's what life is all about. We want out of the rebirth cycle. By the way, after many years of Hinduism, the opinion of almost everyone in the religion is we are sick of samsara. We are tired of the tension of going from body to body to body to body. And they rebelled against it. And that's what gave birth to Buddhism, was rebellion against the samsara, or we call it reincarnation. That's not exactly the right word, but it is the wheel of life that the Hindu, in which the Hindu believes. Now, connected with samsara is another word, karma. I wish I would have remembered it. I didn't write it down. It was on a newscast. And karma was used as though you certainly know what karma is, don't you? And I can't remember the exact context of it, but I know at the time when I heard the word karma used in that context, I said, what did you just say? And I'm sure he said karma, but whatever. Karma is simply this idea. All action has consequence. And that being the case, the actions of this life determine the condition of the next life. Christianity is salvation by sovereign divine grace. What is this? Salvation by works. And if I could say one sentence, world religion is salvation by works. Christianity is salvation by grace. And we'll spend our last time drawing some of these out very clearly. Now, here's the object. You want to work this karma idea so that through enough righteous acts, you'll break out of the cycle. So if good enough, if you can manage to be good enough, you become free from samsara. You're out of it. When you get out of it, there is a third word. M-U-K-T-I. Mukta means liberation from the wheel of life, the wheel of life and rebirth, or freedom from karma. And that essentially hits at the very heart of what a Hindu believes. Okay, stop there and point out that on Wednesday we'll look at Buddhism. And Buddhism reacted to three doctrines that we've talked about tonight. Well, we didn't talk about one. The caste system, the samsara, and the Veda. And along they're going to come and say the Veda is uninspired, it is not from God, it's the opinions of stupid men. And they get really strong on this. He says they were simply egotistical men who wrote the Veda. They are not true, they are not authoritative, and we reject them. They came along and said, samsara, we'll have no more of it. This birth, rebirth cycle, we're through with it. We don't want it. And the caste system will be a part of it also. The caste system simply says that Brahma, God, created the first man whose name was Manu. And Manu had growths coming out his head, hands, thighs, and feet. From the head came the Brahmins. They were the holiest class. From his hands come the Kshatriyas. They were rulers and warriors. From his thighs, the Vaisya, or craftsmen, And from his feet, you probably recognize this term, the common people, the sudras of Hinduism. And out of those came thousands of subcastes. And then out of that came people who didn't know what caste they were from, and so they were outcasts. O-U-T-C-A-S-T-E, and from which our word outcast has come, that has nothing to do, but the word caste and outcast originally had to do with the caste you were in India, and the whole caste system, I believe, by the government is illegal today, but it's still, you can't understand India or anything that's done there without some understanding of the caste system. But we'll get into the rebellion that came up against this next time, which is called Buddhism. Question. I hope they're not too many, because I'm not a pro in these areas, but I know the essentials. Yeah, Larry? Any idea of, and I heard
righteousness.
No. Basically, in your religion, see, we think of righteousness in more in moral terms. They thought of righteousness more in ritual terms, most of your religions. Which simply means if you go through the ritual, you're okay, whatever you did. So you might look at a business deal and say, I can come out better if I lie. So you lie. But don't forget to go through your ritual or God will get mad at you. So you go through the ritual, get the benefits of the lie, and move on. But their idea of righteousness, it's different. See, many cultures even start with a lie. That's the very beginning point of everything they do. Have you ever heard of... Well, when you go even to an Arab country and you say, how much is that bottle of Coke? $5. And you end up doing what? Arriving at the truth and getting it for 50 cents, which he was going to sell it for you in the first place. But it all starts with a lie. I won't sell it for a nickel less than $5. Oh, how about $4.50? Okay. And that's conscience. I remember being in a... Cairo. And I always like, probably at the peril of my life, I like to wander at night. And I'd wandered over by one of the pyramids, and Arab people just have a, and you don't want to judge on this, but you look at those dark eyes and that grayish skin, and you just want to say, I don't trust you. Collins, do you understand what I'm saying? There's something about these eyes back there that just really scares me. And this guy had wanted to sell me a newspaper. And he said, you know, President Reagan is coming to town tomorrow. And you would like to have the newspaper that was published on the day he came to town. He was no more coming to Cairo than the man in the moon. But the guy sold me a newspaper. And I knew I wasn't a fool. It's just that how can I get rid of you, you know? Do you ever get some people and you're in the room with them and you say, is there any, you know, the grocery store last night, I got a hold, I always get behind a woman. Not with coupons, but with a file box of coupons. And I just wanted to say, how much would I have to give you if you would go to the back of the line? And it's just like, you know, have a nice day, but please do it someplace else. But that's I think, to them, ritual is, and your performance. You think of moral right as basically derived from the Judeo scriptures. That's where you're getting your definition. I don't get a definition from that at all. Even clear down to, if it succeeds, it's right. And, by the way, are we far, in many cases, from that? It's not wrong if you can get by with it. But their framework of absolute is entirely different. Yeah. There's someone else over here. Yeah, Nate?
Okay, so you get on a good roll there, and you manage to break the cycle of samsara.
Uh-huh.
Where does that lead you, then? So you're not passing from body to body, that cycle is broken, but where are you?
At rest.
At rest.
Mm-hmm. That's about all you can get out of it, at rest.
Where?
Out of the, well, you got to be careful with places. Because like nirvana, you don't think of as a place like we think of heaven. It's an emotional condition. See, none of us have never picked up on the concept. Like Buddha, he is going to sit under a tree until he wastes to nothing to get enlightened. And I'm sure there's some physiological aspects that come into it. That you become so weakened, who knows what kind of psychological phenomena could happen to your mind under a tremendously weakened condition. The idea again of the body being subservient to the spirit through discipline is heavy in all of these. We mentioned the eating of fruit. Did we mention eating nuts, fruits, and that's all? Plus an enema every third day. Purge your body of evils. And again, I hope you're identifying a little bit. I have known people who I don't think know it. But through some of the emphasis in regards to diet and so forth, are doing nothing more than practicing Hinduism. And we ought to be aware of it. I really don't care to engage in Hindu practices myself. And that isn't part of my viewpoint on life or part of my theology at all, except to know it, to appreciate it, and understand it. Yeah. Dave Collins, you're sitting back there with a smile. I know you're about to say something. Dare you? Never mind. Okay. Good night.